And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues with Schiff now trying to retry everything in the Senate, saying you can't depend on what was done in the House. Who knows where it's going to wind up? I mean, he says now he doesn't know who the whistleblower was, even though he said in the House version that he had talked to the whistleblower. So I don't think you can believe anything Schiff has to say. That all having been said, last night we talked about haunted ships. We're going to talk about a couple of more. In 1850, the population of Victoria in Australia was 76,000. In 1860, there were 538,000. And a whole lot more wanted to travel there. It wasn't an easy journey. 12,000 miles of dangerous sea separated Australia from Britain, where the vast amount of immigrants originated. Augmenting that difference, there was distance, there was discomfort, because most immigrants traveled steerage class. Back came the shocking accommodations. Bad food, disease, seasickness. There was one case of a woman who spent the entire voyage sick. As soon as she got to Australia, died. Well, once the immigrants arrived, things weren't all that much better. The largest Victorian city was Melbourne, which wasn't much better than a large town. And outside of town, there was nothing but heat, bush, and insects. Even the people were looked at as somewhat primitive, because Australia still had the reputation of a convict colony where bushrangers, as they were called, roamed what roads there were. Nevertheless, there were some compensations. Land was cheap, work was available, and there was gold. Well, gold strikes were made in 1850, and as you might guess, yellow fever gripped Australia as vast numbers of people rushed out to the diggings. Despite local employers raising pay, men abandoned their jobs, bought pick, shovel, and provisions, and took out for the gold fields. Gigs and drays and carriages rattled along the roads, filled with diggers who'd once been barristers or clerks or lawyers or policemen. Ordinary laborers struggled along on foot, choking in the dust. When clipper ships carried news of gold to Britain, there was an immediate exodus. Immigrant trade boomed as people, mainly single men, got passage to Australia by any means they could. Now, most sailed as bona fide passengers, but others posed as seamen hoping to desert for the gold fields as soon as they got there. And it was certainly a busy time for shipping. As well as ferrying thousands of passengers across three oceans, ships are also carrying back the products of the gold fields. Gold was escorted on board to be hidden in specially made compartments under the master's cabin. And some of these cargoes were phenomenally valuable, with ships carrying up to £1 million worth of gold dust. That was, at that time, over $2 million. Fast ships were preferred for this task because the owners wanted the gold to have it banked safely in Britain as quickly as possible. One of the fastest was a ship named the Madagascar. Owned by the famous London Blackwall Shipping Line, the Madagascar was captained by Captain Fortescue Harris, an experienced seaman who knew the Australian run well. She sailed out of Port Phillip early in 1853 with the usual contingent of immigrants, and by July lay under the Blue Peter, ready to return to England. As well as passengers, she carried 68,390 ounces of gold dust from the diggings. But just before Captain Harris ordered her to hoist her anchor, there was a loud hail from the shore. Two detectives came on board with warrants to arrest two of the passengers. Captain Harris was just livid that his leaving was interrupted. He demanded to know who the detectives were searching for. Wanted to know what they'd done, and they responded they were bush rangers. They robbed the MacIver gold coach. Well, sure enough, the detectives found gold dust in the suspect's luggage, and Captain Harris had to wait while the trial took place. Well, found not guilty, the passengers seemed to have returned on board, and a month later, the Madagascar sailed for England. In common with so many ships at that time, she vanished without a trace. Passengers, gold, ship, everything vanished. That was unless anybody heard of the Madagascar. Some folks claimed that she had sunk in a storm. Others talked about pirates, and one or two, recalling the MacIver gold robbery, talked about a mutiny. It wasn't for many years an old woman in New Zealand told a story about the Madagascar's last voyage. Nearing death, the old woman called for a clergyman and unburdened herself of her secrets. She'd been a nurse in her youth and had sailed on board Madagascar when that ship left Melbourne for England. First, everything on the voyage had gone smoothly, but somewhere in the South Atlantic, some of the crew and a number of passengers had mutinied. There'd been a terrible scene on the ship as the mutineers hunted down and murdered the officers and then gradually captured all the other passengers. While the men, women, and the elderly women and the children are locked up below, the young, good-looking women are kept separate in relatively reasonable conditions. The old woman remembered their fear because it was obvious why they were being kept alive. Well, after a few days, the mutineers ordered all the boats lowered, forced the young women into them, together with the gold they had taken from its hiding place. When the mutineers and women were on board the heaving, jolting lifeboats, the ship was set on fire. The lifeboats sailed away, leaving the Madagascar, together with the other prisoners, a burning, smoking wreck. Well, as successful as they might have been at murder, the mutineers really weren't sailors. As they rowed toward the coast of Brazil, the lifeboats capsized till only one was left. And despite the desperate attempts of the men on board, even that boat sank in the surf of the South American coast. Gold dust was lost before the few survivors crawled ashore. And there were no more dreams of luxurious living as the sun-scorched mutineers dragged themselves through the hostile land, hoping to find shelter and food. Yellow fever killed some, one went mad, and a battered handful crawled into a tiny Brazilian village. Only one or two of the mutineers survived, and with them was their hostage, the one-time nurse. The nurse hung on as the men disappeared. One was lost, maybe to die in the Brazilian rainforest. The other was fled to Frisco, where he got involved in a brawl and killed a man. He was then hung for murder. But when the minister heard the story, he could do little but prepare the old woman for her death. He knew that many questions remained. Why had she delayed telling her tale for so long? Was she perhaps implicated in the mutiny? Or did she make the entire thing up? Well, the whole tale is repeated by folklorist, and after that, at least one respected nautical historian, but the whole story was false. There was a vessel named Madagascar, and she did carry gold, but she vanished in 1853 without any trace. All the rest is speculation, but it does make a pretty good story. Not so the story of the Betsy Cairns. She was no graceful clipper ship, but a Northumbrian collier. But her story could stand beside any in fiction or fact. Now, with proper care and maintenance, a wooden vessel could endure an almost indefinite life. Sometimes ships would undergo many transformations as they were used in different capacities. For instance, a ship built for the timber trade from Quebec could be sold to a whaling company and later work in the Baltic flax trade. But few vessels can have experienced the transformation the Betsy Cairns did. When she came ashore at Teignmouth in February 1827, she was working as a collier, 83 feet long, beam of 23 feet, and like most colliers, rigged as a brig. However, unlike most colliers, her mizzen yard was set for a lateen sail, and her stem and stern were highly decorated with gilding and elaborate carving. Well, colliers were essential to the economy of a nation that ran on coal. Coal fueled the fires of a million homes and provided power for steam locomotives, steam engines, steam-powered looms, and steam-powered factories. Without coal, there was no steam, and without steam, there was no Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution kept Britain at the forefront of the world. Without colliers, there would not be any of that coal. Well, at one time, a man known as Records had plagued the coast of England. But when Betsy Cairns came aground, it was souvenir hunters who flocked to the ship. Rather than loot the cargo, they pulled the wreck to pieces in their search for a memento of a vessel which they believed had played an important part in the history of Britain. In the 19th century, Geordie Colliers had a reputation for toughness and seamanship second to none. Other seamen turned them Geordie Colliers because they were presumed to be uneducated, uncouth, and rough. Scorning luxuries, the Geordies would climb aboard their vessel with a rope rather than a gangplank, ate the simplest of fare, and often scorned book learning. But they knew the East Coast and the North Sea better than almost any other man in the world. Where the vessels would sound on anybody who could haul a rope, the Tyneside Colliers accepted only half-mariners or men who signed articles of apprenticeship. They had to undergo 7 often brutal years of training before they could be considered fit to sit the examination for an able seaman. And that examination was an ordeal in itself. A committee of 4-mast hands would put the candidate through a thorough investigation. It tested him in every aspect of seamanship, from fitting a mast cover to putting a reef kringle in a sail, from gammoning a bowsprit to making a Turk's head from a rope's end. If he failed in any part, he failed at all. He had to return to his lowly position as ordinary seaman for another period of learning before the committee would consider reconvening to see if he could pass the test again. Now, such hard schooling was considered necessary because the North Sea was a vicious taskmaster. No quiet sea of predictable weather patterns and warm winds. The North Sea is shallow, dirty, and treacherous. Squalls can kick up out of nothing, and the coastline is close and dangerous with few safe anchorages and a terrifying medley of shoals and rocks and ugly tides. If a man isn't a seaman, he's a liability to his shipmates. With men such as this, it's no wonder that vessels were kept afloat for generation after generation. But even so, the Betsy Cairns was something special. There were rumors she had been built as a West Indies sugar ship, one of the prestigious vessels that provided prosperity to Britain in the early days of the empire. And there were also rumors that she had had an even more auspicious career. When she was wrecked, the Newcastle Courant claimed that in 1688, the Betsy Cairns brought over to England William, Prince of Orange, and was then called the Princess Mary. For a number of years, she was one of Queen Anne's royal yachts, and at that time was considered a remarkably fast sailing vessel. Well, at the time of her wreck in 1827, not only ardent royalists were interested in the career of the Betsy Cairns. It was a period of much religious and political disputes when Catholic emancipation was seen as potentially damaging to the security of the state. Strangely enough, the supposed history of the Betsy Cairns was tightly tied to the political-religious debate. There was even a legend that there could be no emancipation as long as the ship that allegedly carried King William was afloat. Well, Plo, an anti-emancipationist, either hoped for her demise or prayed for her continual survival. There was a rumor that the Betsy Cairns was deliberately sunk that February day in 1827. Not even the most fervent pro-emancipator was capable of whistling up a North Sea squall. Historians have disputed the fact that the Betsy Cairns could have carried King William, although possibly she was originally the royal yacht Mary, which transported Mary to England. However, only 2 years later, the Catholic Emancipation Act was passed, so maybe there was a little magic in that ship at all. We'll never know. Well, there were 3 words that every seafarer near Dependence feared: missing without trace. Throughout history, there have been so many ships that disappeared, it's impossible to calculate their number. In the days of sail, before radio or satellite, ships could be at sea for months without communication. With no fixed date of arrival, there was no way of determining if the ship was lost or merely delayed till it was too late for the crew. Delays by bad weather or bad luck were common. Storm, piracy, mutiny, or the unknown. Mariners could face any of these Every voyage, and although piracy diminished in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it's never been completely eradicated. And indeed, it's now returned on a scale unknown since the Royal Navy's anti-pirate patrols kept it under control. Sir Walter Runciman, in his book Before the Mast and After, mentions piracy. He wrote, "I had pretty narrow escapes in the Grecian archipelago twice and once in Tunis Bay." He describes a black, snipish-looking vessel of the slave schooner type and writes of an attempt to board as his vessel lay at anchor. And that was in the latter half of the 19th century, at the height of Pax Britannica. Ships are always under threat of piracy among the islands of the East, the Philippines, and the Celebs being notorious. And there were always Chinese pirates ready to pounce as well. But piracy, though, was actually among the least of the mariners' concerns. In 1886, Professor Francis Elgar addressed the Institute of Naval Architects on the subject of ship losses and stated that 264 British vessels of over 300 tons had sunk between 1881 and 1883. These vessels were missing without trace. 86 had carried coal and 44 had carried grain, he said. And he linked the loss of the ships to the shift of cargo in bad weather. According to Captain Learmont, a Sahwe mariner, you can lose a ship anywhere and in so many ways. Fight the shore bastards and look after the ship all the time. Well, it was believed he would have known while sailing Ben-Garen from Newcastle to Valparaiso, he ran into bad weather in the Tasman Sea. The Ben-Garen heeled over and he said, "I thought I was getting a lesson on what happened to missing ships on that run," he wrote. The coal shifted, smashing through the main hatch, and the Ben-Garen was right over on her beams in. Only superb seamanship saved her from going down. He covered the gaping hatch with a sail, hacked free the top gallant mast, the royal mast, and the connecting spars, and spent days of anxiety and backbreaking labor restoring the coal. The Ben-Garen reached Sydney safely, but rather than accept the dockyard's quote for replacing mast and rigging, Learmont and his crew did the work themselves. And sometimes ships had a lucky escape from the unknown. On June 16, 1899, Annan-born Captain William Nelson rounded the Cape of Good Hope and Accomas of Mayport, or Maryport, rather, reported, "We had the startling experience of a thunderbolt dropping very close to the ship. Same time, a sudden gust of wind split the upper and lower topsails on both main and mizzen." Well, if this thunderbolt or meteor, as he put it in the log, had landed on Accomas, what would have been her chances of survival? And who would have known what had happened to her? This same Captain Nelson has a connection, tenuous though it might be, with one of the major mysteries of the ocean, the loss of the Rarita. On a latter voyage of Accomas, he carried seven apprentices. The voyage lasted well over 2 years, and five of the apprentices stayed full-term, being paid off in Glasgow. One of these, Apprentice Hemi, was promoted to third mate of SS Commonwealth and then to the steamliner Rarita. After the hardship and strenuous work of a sailing ship, life on a steam passenger liner must have seemed like heaven. But the sea was never a respecter of luxury. The Clydeside firm of Barclay, Curl & Company built Rarita in 1908. At 9,339 tons, she was the largest ship in the Blue Anchor Line and was intended to operate on the London to Sydney route. As the flower emblem of the New South Wales, Rarita symbolized good luck. With the veteran Captain Ilberry in command, the Rarita successfully completed her maiden voyage to Sydney via Cape Town and Durban, and returned to London. Her second outward voyage seemed equally serene, and on the 7th day of July, 1909, the Rarita, with 82 passengers and a mixed cargo of wheat, wool, and frozen meat, left Sydney for Durban. There was a severe gale in mid-ocean, but Ilberry brought her safely through. The chief engineer seemed satisfied as her quadruple expansion engines thrust her forward at a steady speed, despite her violent reactions in the steep seas. When they arrived in Durban, Ilberry held a celebration for the return to London, because that was going to be his last voyage. He was 69 and going to retire. Well, on July 26, more passengers boarded, more cargo was loaded, and the coal bunkers were filled. At 8 in the evening, Captain Hugh Lindsay, the pilot, came aboard. An hour later, Robert Tyre left harbor. That was a three-day journey to Cape Town, and one day out, Robert Tyre met Clan MacIntyre of Glasgow. After exchange of news, Clan MacIntyre signaled goodbye, pleasant voyage, and Robert Tyre replied, same to you, goodbye. And that was the last anybody saw or heard of the good ship Rarita. There had been a severe storm off Southeast Africa, and many vessels scurried into the nearest ports for shelter, but the Rarita wasn't among them. When she hadn't appeared by the beginning of August, a massive search began. The cruisers HMS Forte, HMS Pandora, HMS Hermes, the tug T.E. Fuller, the blue anchor liner Geelong, and the Union Castle liner Sabine all scoured the sea for wreckage. They checked the coast for stranded survivors, but they found nothing. Border Trade Inquiry debated the disappearance. One theory said that her long promenade deck made her unstable, liable to capsize. Now, the builders, of course, denied this. The Durban pilot, Captain Lindsay, thought the Robert Tyre was unsuitable for the short, steep waves that rose off the Cape. He proposed a huge wave had burst through her long forward hatch. Claude Sawyer, one of the passengers on the earlier voyage, claimed that Robert Tyre had been so top-heavy, her rolling had knocked people to the deck. After a succession of nightmares in which Robert Tyre had capsized, Sawyer had canceled his booking and there saved his life. Before leaving Durban, Robert Tyre had loaded 1,700 tons of coal, too much for the bunkers, so the excess was piled on deck. And it was thought by some that this coal had shifted during the storm. And some people claimed that Ilberry himself had criticized Robert Tyre's handling. It was said he would only withdraw his complaints after he was offered a good retirement. Surely unlikely a captain of 30-odd years' experience would sail on a ship he considered unseaworthy. But it was easy to slander a missing man, which is exactly what happened. After a loss, a clutch of stories came out, a minister meeting one of the dead passengers. According to the minister, in his dream, he told the dead passenger, you were lost in the Rarita, and the passenger responded, yes, we turned over off East London. Or the woman who had intended to sail but had a premonition of a disaster, and so she canceled. All the same, and somewhat unusually, she did allow her husband and two of her children to sail. Of course, she never saw them again. So what happened? Did the Robert Tyre capsize in heavy seas? Was this Clyde-built ship top-heavy? Did her coal shift? Or was there a combination of some or all of these? Well, her loss prompted the use of wireless on ships on that route, and that change in turn probably saved hundreds of lives. Well, 19 years after the disappearance of the Rarita, another Scottish-built ship vanished mysteriously. This was the Cabinhaven, 430-foot, five-masted bark, and the largest sailing ship ever built at Leith. 1914, the East Asiatic Company of Copenhagen ordered her built by Ramage and Ferguson, but the First World War intervened. The Admiralty requisitioned this vessel. So a second identical ship was ordered and launched in the autumn of 1921. Primarily intended as a fast-sailing ship, she also carried an auxiliary engine for entering port in case of emergency. East Asiatic Company meant her to be a training ship for cadets, at the same time still working as a commercial cargo carrier. And for a number of years, she sailed successfully. But then on December 14, 1928, she left Buenos Aires for Melbourne with a crew of 55, very young crewmen. She was never seen again. As in the case of the Rarita, there was an extensive search, but nothing was found. And in 1995, when the visit of the tall ships raced to Leith brought back memories, came a possible solution. An article in Edinburgh's Evening News invited comments, and one of those comments shed a little light on the matter. The island of Tristan da Cunha sits in the South Atlantic, remote from and ignored by the world until the volcanic eruption of 1961 brought evacuation and publicity. One of the islanders stated the loss of the Cabinhaven was no mystery because he'd watched her go down off the north end of the island. Asked why he hadn't told anybody, the man said back then it wasn't possible to just pick up a telephone. It is possible many other nautical mysteries could have been solved by asking people on remote islands and isolated areas. Inuit of Northern Canada had stories of the loss of the Franklin expedition of the 1840s and stories about unknown white men of perhaps centuries earlier. Were there silent witnesses to the fate of Henry Hudson set adrift in Hudson Bay by his son with his son and seven men? How about the voyage of the mate of the Greencock, Whaler John? 1829, while under the command of Captain Coombe, the crew of the John mutinied off Loch Ryan. Next year, with the same captain and some of the same crew, the John sailed out for whaling. Somewhere in the Arctic, Captain Coombe died, and there must have been another mutiny because the mate and the boat's crew were set adrift in a freezing sea and disappeared from history. Like so many whalers that summer, John was sunk, taking her log with her. Very unlikely the mate survived. Well, while some people did survive shipwrecks and in most unlikely of environments, in the early years of rounding the Cape of Good Hope, dozens of ships were lost. There's strange tales of survivors turning up years later after being rescued and adopted by the local tribes. The southeast coast of Africa, the area in which the Rarotonga presumably foundered, was notorious for such episodes. There was a clutch of wrecks in the early 1550s. The St. Jerome was lost with all hands north of the Maluzu mouth in Zululand. The San Joa, carrying 610, was wrecked off today's Port St. John. 500 of those people made it to land. 25 reached the nearest Portuguese settlement. Others, the sick, the injured, the despondent, were left at Crawls, as they were called, the length of the journey. Those were little settlements. Also, the St. Benedict that came ashore in Pondo Land. Her survivors gave the name Rio de Mandeos de Oro to the Tongaland coast, River of the Downs of Gold, is how it's translated. During the next 50 years, thousands of survivors staggered onto African soil, but only 500 arrived at what they termed civilization. The remainder either died or joined the local peoples. One Englishman shipwrecked in the closing years of the 17th century met a Portuguese man who survived a wreck more than 40 years before. The Portuguese had been so integrated into the Amapondo that he was content to remain an African tribesman. And why not? The African royal wife was probably as good as or superior to that of most Europeans. After the discipline and poor food on board ships, kraal life must have been an improvement. One Scottish casualty on this coast is William Falconer, the Edinburgh-born poet and seaman. He was wrecked twice in his career, once off the coast of Greece and the second and last time when the HMS Aurora foundered off the Cape in 1769. Falconer's best remembered for his longest poem, which was ironically entitled The Shipwreck. 1790, an expedition searching for the survivors of an Indiaman lost 8 years before came across a kraal on the Umgazana River. There were 400 people there, all claiming descent from three European women who'd been wrecked on the Natal coast many years before. Children played around the three grandmothers or the great-grandmothers who recalled only they'd been cast ashore as children. At one time, there were so many wrecks around South-East Africa, the Bantu had a legend of a strange white race that lived on the bottom of the sea. Rather than UFOs, their legends dealt with the unidentified marine people, the UMPs. And unnumbered Africans were the witnesses to these tragedies. Now, the Scottish coast has also seen its share of shipping losses and mysteries. 50 yards off Kemmachere in Herta, the main island of the St. Kilda group, Mina Stack protrudes from the sea. At one time, according to legend, there was a natural archway between this stack and the cliffs of Herta. During the storms of 1588, one of the fleeing ships of the Spanish Armada was driven toward the island. Either the ferocity of the storm hid the nature of the arch, or the captain attempted to squeeze his ship underneath, but his topmast struck the rock above. The resulting rock fall resulted in hundreds of tons of stone not only sinking the ship, but isolating the stack. There was no mention of any survivors. It's doubtful if the Spanish government asked the people of St. Kilda if they knew anything about a missing ship. After all, state of war existed at the time. Although this particular wreck may be apocryphal, these four Spanish vessels did founder off the Scottish coast. The most famous of these lies in Tappamore Bay. This was to transport San Juan de Sicilia, and there's stories of Spanish soldiers being used as mercenaries by McLean of Durrant and of a lone clansman blowing up the ship. Another, just north of Collieston and St. Catherine's Dub, was probably sunk in the early 1590s. A third, called Brea Amberg, went down off Fair Isle, while El Gran Griffin was driven under the Fair Isle cliffs in September of 1588. Now, this was not the first nor the last wreck on Fair Isle. Earliest known was in 900 A.D. when a Viking longship came to grief. And the last? Well, will there ever be a last shipwreck? Those Spaniards were the lucky ones. More common was the end of the Robert Steele-built Scottish crude Ramsdale. This was a fine ship used for both the jute trade and the North Pacific grain trade. She once crossed from Tail of the Bank to Montreal and back to Liverpool in 37 days. She sailed from Dundee to Rangoon in 97 days. These were considered excellent times. Under Captain White, she was a happy ship, with Ms. White adding the family touch with the best seagoing women could. On October 31st, 1891, in company with County of Selkirk, Ramsdale left Chittagong with a cargo of jute. Within 2 days, she was battling a cyclone. Only wreckage of Ramsdale's ever been found, although County of Selkirk, better positioned when the storm hit, survived. There was no fault with the Ramsdale, her captain, or her crew, but the sea could be very hard on sailing ships. Among the most beautiful of creations, they could also be killers. When the times passed, many seamen believed their vessels had an individual character. And there were stories about ships that could navigate their own passage across the Atlantic, and ships that could find their own familiar berth even on the foggiest of days. And one way of expressing this individuality was through the figurehead that was affixed to most ships. One of the most famous figureheads was surely that of Cutty Sark, where a buxom woman thrusts herself before the ship, wearing only the Cutty Sark, or short shirt that Burns featured in his poem. Cutty Sark, though, was not unique. In the 19th century, it wasn't uncommon for ships to have a bare-breasted woman as figurehead. It was a prevailing superstition among seamen at the time that such a sight would calm down the wrath of the sea and ensure a smooth passage. And as the Cutty Sark was one of the few clipper ships to have survived from that great age of sail, perhaps there's no reason to scoff at the idea. Ships' companies tended to believe that their figurehead was a good luck charm and kept it in good repair, with some receiving scores of coats of paint as protection against the weather. Any damage to a figurehead meant a corresponding lowering of morale in the ship, but sometimes retaining a figurehead could be a liability. Well, during the American War of Independence, the Royal Navy and the British privateers decimated American shipping. One of the vessels captured was the U.S. privateer True Love, which the British used as a whaling ship. Sailing from Hull, True Love was an extremely successful whale hunter, but she had one drawback. Her figurehead attracted ice. Whaling ships worked in the worst environment in the world, right on or often beyond the edge of the Arctic ice. They acted as mother ships while the small whaling boats rowed or sailed out to hunt for the whales. And every year there were casualties, with ships being punctured or crushed by the ice and men suffering from disease or frostbite. Whalers are known as Greenland men, and they didn't need an additional hazard, so when it was realized the figurehead was gathering so much ice that it would pull the True Love down by the head, it had to go. So without her figurehead, she sailed on for many years. Despite the dangers, other whaling vessels displayed a figurehead. There was a chieftain out of Dundee who boasted the figurehead of a Highland warrior. She had something of a checkered history, losing many of her crew when they were out sealing in a thick Greenland fog to accompanying rumors of cannibalism. There was the Arctic, which Alexander Stephen built in late 1875. One of the few whaling vessels to have a public house named in her honor. Arctic was 828 tons in gross weight and over 200 feet long. Her figurehead was distinctive, too, an Inuit holding a lance who guided Arctic into becoming one of the most celebrated of the entire Dundee fleet. Well, many maritime peoples have used figureheads on ships. The origins are mysterious, but possibly contain both religious symbolism and a personification of the ship. One theory suggests the very early mariners believed the sea was divine and offered a human sacrifice when they launched a new ship. There are tales of early ships being physically launched across the human body so that the blood helped smooth their passage to the sea. Other legends say that a human was beheaded and the head placed on the bow of the boat where the sea god couldn't fail to see it. But as more ships were built, it became difficult to find enough sacrifices. I mean, let's face it, if you knew there was a ship being built and there's going to be a sacrifice needed, you might make yourself scarce. So in place of the original human sacrifice, somebody fashioned a crude head out of wood or maybe a mop of rope. In time, this became common and was accepted as the figurehead of the boat. I mean, there are, of course, many other theories. Like so many things nautical, figureheads were known in the ancient Mediterranean, where Egyptian vessels carried carvings of holy birds on the prow. It's possible the Egyptian figureheads were detachable to be changed depending on the altered use of the vessel. The insignia on the poop of these heavily curved crafts certainly was. The figureheads were regarded as more than merely ornamental, as proven by the Phoenicians, those functional mariners, traders, and slavers of the Levant. Their black ships were the epitome of professionalism, but carried the figureheads of a horse's head. Religion, superstition, and seamanship have always been very closely intertwined. Fighting Greek ships boasted the head of a boar. The Romans thought that nothing but the car of centurion could demonstrate the power of their ships. The oldest surviving figurehead that we have information about is that of a Greek trireme, the winged victory of Samothrace that now graces the Louvre. Demetrius, a soldier who fought for the great Alexander, set up this creation at Samothrace in 306 BC. And if it may never have decorated the prow of a ship, it is surely representative of others that did. His figurehead proclaims that Alexander's Macedonians were the masters of the sea as well as the land, much as the representation of Britannia's shouted triumph 2,000 years or more in the future. Well, legend claims the Vikings often decorated the prow of their longships with the heads of their victims. More sober history credits Norse ships with serpents and dolphins or bulls. But Svend Forkbeard of Denmark sailed a unique dragon ship, with the stern of the vessel decorated as the creature's tail and a dragon's head as the figurehead. The Normans, lineal descendants of the Vikings, also used figureheads. When William the Conqueror crossed the Channel in 1066, his ship had a lion's head as a figurehead. While most maritime nations could exchange ideas and techniques, the people of the furthest east seemed to have gone their own way in many things. Neither the Japanese nor the Chinese used figurehead on their vessels. The Chinese contented themselves with an eye so that ship could find her own way. Further east, the war canoes of the Moroi had an amazingly elaborate carving. In early medieval Europe, some seamen would refuse to sail unless a ship bore a figurehead that could scare away demons. By that time, the style for European figureheads had rigidified into either a dragon or a large fish whose protuberant tongue doubled as a ram. Well, the first recorded British figurehead seems to have been that of the Trinity Royale in 1416, which carried the Royal English Leopard crowned with copper on her beak head. By the 16th century, figureheads on Scottish or English ships are often related to the name of the vessel. For instance, the Scottish warship Unicorn had a unicorn figurehead. It was a 19th century warship of that name in Victoria Dock, Dundee, with a fine unicorn figurehead. But in spite of that, there seemed to be no fixed rule, for the 16th century English vessel Mary Rose also had a unicorn figurehead. In the 17th and 18th century, naval decoration reached a peak, with each royal vessel vying in elaborate decoration with the next. Sovereign of the Seas, later renamed Sovereign and Royal Sovereign, were a very busy vessel. In her 60-year career, she took part in no less than 6 major fleet actions. Her figurehead was a splendid representation of historical propaganda. Showed a mounted King Edgar trampling down the 7 kings, and English documents claim rode his royal barge. Our British battleships contented themselves with figureheads of royalty. The French were supreme in the art of elaboration. The French flagship, the Roi Soleil, carried a figurehead of a mermaid, while another 3-deck battleship had a female in flowing robes with a trumpet in one hand, a flag in the other, standing on a carpet of oak leaves. Smaller European warships in the 17th century often carried a lion rampant figurehead, whatever their nationality might be. The shape, angle, or sweep of the lion followed fixed rules that shipbuilders had to obey. 1703, the English Admiralty ordered that the lion should be the figurehead for every royal warship below the first rate. Now, standardization continued in the 18th century when many ships carried a figurehead of a Roman soldier. Classical education in public school had turned the nautical wheel full circle as Demerary, Warrior, Royal George, and Kent fought behind the same figurehead that led their Roman vessels 2,000 years before. To continue the classical theme, Neptune, the Roman sea god, also acted as a figurehead, while the one-eyed Cyclops stared out from the beak of Polyhemus. However, dragon slaying St. George added a touch of medieval Christianity to other vessels. Interestingly, it was the 19th century that figureheads achieved their full potential. While some hark back to the past, such as Royal Adelaide, which had a double life-size carving of the Queen, other vessels had more individuality. The topsail schooner Devil carried Lucifer on her bow. Reputation supported her name. Black-painted, she hailed from Preston and crossed the Atlantic at a devilishly fast speed, despite the bad weather that seemed to dog her raking hull. Rumor said the Devil was sailing along the West African coast when her crew sicked with a fever. With only her figurehead to guide her, the Devil disappeared forever. Styx was another diabolical vessel with a naked devil, painted bitter brown as a figurehead. Of course, not all figureheads were so dramatic. In 1830, the East Indiaman Thames had the figure of Father Thames, complete with a trident, a London version of Neptune. As some colorful stories were spun around the 19th century figureheads. One of the most interesting concerned the ship Java, which was built in Calcutta in 1813. Java's figurehead was a representation of a naked woman with her hands pressed together in prayer. According to the story, the man who ordered her built also handed her to an officer of the Honorable East India Company. The builder was a British merchant who had traded along the coast of the East, often taking his wife and family with him. Now, these coasts were dangerous in the early 19th century with various types of pirate and broken men waiting to attack merchant vessels. And while the merchant was away, a group of savages snatched his daughter and disappeared into the wilds of the jungle. Now, the merchantman was distraught, but he was a man of trade, not a man of war. Luckily, a British officer heard about the kidnapping and got together a force of adventurers. Now, they followed the trail of the missing girl, going through the dense jungle till they located the camp of the kidnappers. There was a brief skirmish with pistols popping and swords flickering, and the officer found the merchant's daughter naked and afraid but unhurt in the middle of the camp. Though the story does appear to be apocryphal, it does give some color to the figurehead. In 1833, the government ended the East India Company's exclusive charter to trade with India. Green and Wigram's shipbuilding yard at Blackwall in London immediately stepped into the vacancy and built a number of vessels for the Indian trade. These ships were known as Blackwall frigates, mainly because they were faster than the bulky East Indiaman. Seringapatam was the first Blackwall frigate. Built in 1837, she weighed 818 tons and set a new speed record between London and Bombay. Known as Old Seringy, Seringapatam was often remembered for another of her attributes. Her figurehead represented Tipu Sahib, complete with a drawn scimitar. Tipu Sahib, or Tipu Sultan, was one of the East Indiaman Company's most formidable enemies. When his father, Hyder Ali, was Sultan of Mysore, Tipu defeated three successive British armies and captured many British soldiers, including the redoubtable Captain David Baird, who then became Sultan himself. Tipu kept Baird a prisoner for 4 years, but even after peace, he remained a major player in the politics of southern India. Inevitably, another war began, and David Baird, now a major general, led the army that captured Tipu's capital of Seringapatam. It's a good story, and Tipu had been a worthwhile enemy, so there was no shame in naming a ship in his honor. Certainly, the people of southern India never forgot their sultan, and whenever the Seringapatam sailed up the Calcutta River, they salaamed and saluted the figurehead. A great warrior, Tipu also proved a fine figurehead because he led the Seringapatam safely past icebergs in 1841 and survived a cyclone in 1851. Well, the 19th century was prodigal with the lives of ships and men. Every year, scores of ships would sink off without a trace, leaving only another mystery of the sea. However, there were occasions when the figurehead of a lost ship would float ashore, carrying a mute tale of death and loss and sorrow. In 1869, the ship Blue Jacket caught fire off the Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic. Her crew abandoned her, taken to the boats, and thought they'd hear no more about their ship. However, in December 1871, 2 years and 9 months later, the sea washed the figurehead of the Blue Jacket onto Rottnest Island in Western Australia, thousands of miles away from where she went down. She'd made her last landfall. And although figureheads are usually based on historical, mythical, or literary personalities, there were occasions when a living woman was honored. In the 19th century, Dundee was a very busy port with whaling ships sailing to the Arctic, brigs bound for the Baltic, and the great Jute clippers sailing from Bengal and back. The Cox family owned what was probably the largest jute factory in the world, with a workforce of 5,000 in its Lockheed Mill, a private railway, and a majority shareholding in a fleet of clipper ships. His fleet was commonly known as the Dundee Clipper Line. Around 1870, one of the Dundee Clippers was named Duntroon in honor of the house of Ms. Clementina Graham of Duntroon, who was a descendant of Graham of Carver House, who was better known as Bloody Caverse or Bonnie Dundee, depending on whether the speaker was a Jacobite or a Covenanter. Ms. Graham was also a friend of Admiral Duncan, victor of the Battle of Camperdown, and a notable author who wrote Mystification. She also named Duntroon, launched her, and at the age of 95, modeled the figurehead. It's not likely there could be many people who could match that. Today, there are few, if any, figureheads on commercial vessels. But people are strongly interested in these unwieldy, unseemanlike objects that added weight to the ship. They were part of life for tens of thousands of seamen over the thousands of years, a sort of shipborne talisman. Yet, it's unlikely anybody could explain their attraction. Maybe the figureheads did indeed impart personality to ships, or maybe there was something more. Something that only seamen on long, lonely voyages could understand. To the landsman, of course, figurehead would always appear strange, but to the seamen, there was something familiar about it. You know, from the time that mariners first pushed out behind the horizon, there have been tales of strange creatures that live in the sea. Sometimes the tales were about monsters, at other times they were of selkies or seal people, but often they talked about mermaids. Many mariners spoke of these creatures with the top half of a human and the lower half of a fish, but modern science has dismissed the tales as delusion, fiction, or outright lies. Modern writers talk about dugongs or manatees, the gentle creatures that gaze along the seabed near the coast. But these creatures bear only a superficial resemblance to humans. However sex-starved a seaman might be after a long voyage, is unlikely to mistake an ugly, whiskered, broad-faced dugong for the silky beauty of a mermaid. Well, in 1730, Louis Lenard, a British spy in the Netherlands, published a book showing the sea creatures that were supposed to exist in the great southern sea. One of the more exotic was a mermaid with a rather woebegone expression on her face and a short note about her lifestyle. Apparently, this creature lived on shore in a tub for 4 days and 7 hours. It occasionally uttered cries like that of a mouse. Now, such misleading information wasn't unusual in an age which favored phrases such as "here be dragons" rather than geographical knowledge to fill in the blank spaces in maps, but it did bring public attention to ponder on the possible existence of mermaids. Spread over centuries and from seas and coasts across half the world, the accounts still have the ability to mystify and fascinate. What's interesting is the matter-of-fact manner in which sightings are entered into a ship's log. The ship's master frequently put down the bare facts with no attempt at justification or judgment, simply wrote what he saw. In 1607, Henry Hudson, an English explorer of the Arctic, wrote that one of his men saw a mermaid, long-haired, white, and human-breasted at one end and mackerel speckled at the other. Now, there have never been any reports of the tropical dugongs in the cold waters off Spitsbergen, while Hudson's journal is filled with sightings such as July 9th, the day we're among islands of ice where we saw many seals. June 29th, there are many walruses in the sea near us. Now, these seamen were well aware of the difference between a seal and a mermaid, and they're also aware that mermaids were not common. In 1610, Richard Whitbourne was standing by the water in St. John's in Newfoundland when he saw a strange creature. He said the animal came swimming toward him looking cheerfully as if it had been a woman. It seemed to be so beautiful and those parts so well proportioned. Joined by a companion, Whitbourne watched the creature swim nearby, whereby beheld the shoulders and back down to the middle to be as square, white, and smooth as the back of a man, and from the middle to the hinder part, pointing in proportion. Other men, including Whitbourne's servant, William Hawkridge, watched as the creature came close with both his hands on the side of the boat, whereas they were afraid, and one of them struck it a full blow on the head where it fell off. At the sight of the creature, two other boats, for fear, fled to land. According to Whitbourne, this was a mermaid. And mermaids seem to have a vast geographical spread. On November 11, 1602, the Honorable East Indian Company ship Ascension reported seeing a pair of mermaids. The report, which was somewhat laconic, said their hind parts were divided into two legs, while the ship's husband believed that they were husband and wife because the most of one of their heads was longer than the other. Rather than be astonished at the sight, the report continued, "They say there are signs of bad weather, and that's what we found it to be." Reports suggest the possibility of bad weather was more important than the sighting of the mermaid for themselves. 100 years later, the English vessel Worcester of 160 tons and 16 guns was just without Delgoa River mouth when the crew saw a mermaid. They reported that a creature appeared to them out of the water 3 times successfully within about 10 yards of the boat, continuing some time out of the water at each of these appearances, staring the men in the face and then dived under the water. It lifted itself out of the water to the waist and was the bigness of a large woman of a tawny complexion with dark brown hair on the head hanging down over the shoulders and stared from such time at each of its appearances. Seemed to be no specific time, year, or place for seeing mermaids. On the 26th of August, 1912, Gerald Piero of the Cape Verde Islands, while serving on the United States welding brig Daisy, saw what he called a surreal mermaid. Reported it quite laconically, saying as if there was nothing really unusual about the sight. While most pieces of sea folklore are confined to seamen, land-based people also occasionally meet mermaids. The Scottish coast in particular seem to hold a fascination for these elusive creatures, which have a longer history than may be supposed. Mary Queen of Scots was often depicted as a mermaid, which was supposed to be an immoral creature, but serious-minded clerics held long discussions as to whether mermaids had souls. November 1811, there was a formal tribunal in Campbelltown to investigate local sightings of a mermaid. An 8-year-old child named Catherine Loinachan had seen the creature, which she had believed to be a boy from a shipwreck. She reported the creature had rubbed its breast with one hand before it slipped into the water and swam away. Now, a local girl, Catherine, would know all about sea creatures that came onto the Kintyre Peninsula, and her evidence was backed by a mature man named John McIsaac, who saw a creature lying on the rock. He said the top half was white and shaped like a human body, and the other half toward the tail of a brindled or reddish-gray color, apparently covered with scales. But the extremity of the tail itself was a greenish-red shining color. Other Scottish sightings include a mermaid on a rock in Caithness, another in the Isle of Muck, and one in Sandwood Bay in Sutherland in 1900. January 1832, the Inverness Advertiser gave a relatively detailed report of a mermaid sighting. Newspaper said the crew of a boat from Ullapool discovered a figure, apparently that of a man engaged in fishing. To the other amazement, the crew found it to be partly the likeness of a human being, of which the uppermost half resembled a female and was white as snow. The other half was a sky blue color and had fins and a tail like a fish. They said the monster was very tame and had soft rolling eyes. So were these stories truth or fiction? His examples are only samples from a vast amount of sightings over many centuries and in many seas. It's unlikely so many people would have simply made up their stories, particularly as they would have expected ridicule from their peers. Maybe they were mistaken or did in fact see a seal or some other marine creature. However, experienced seamen will be well aware of the difference between a seal or a dugong or an otter and an unknown creature. Bering, for instance, saw an unusual creature on August 10, 1741, as he was sailing off Alaska. Named the creature a sea ape. He described it as having a head like a dog with erect pointed ears, large eyes, thick body hair, long whiskers. Had no 4 feet but a divided flipper or tail. Now, this creature is later identified as a bachelor fur seal. To date, nobody has identified an animal that answers the descriptions of a mermaid. Maybe then there are still some unknown creatures in the sea waiting to be discovered. Maybe the aggression shown to them by past seamen have driven away until humanity is more civilized. So why aren't mermaids seen today? Maybe motor engines scare them or the speed of modern vessels precludes the sightings. It is intriguing to think that there might be some race of animals in the sea that resemble us in part, but until such time as an animal is identified on film, mermaids are destined to remain just a little mystery of the sea. And, of course, there's the albatross. That's another creature that's entered the realm of nautical mythology, but there's no doubt about its reality. It was Samuel Taylor Coleridge in his 1798 poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, who popularized the albatross in the minds of the literate. Seamen, however, had long regarded this massive bird with its 15-foot wingspread with something like awe. The albatross is a native of the southern hemisphere and often follows the ship for weeks at a time, remaining on station with its wings tipped erect and its eyes constantly questing. British seamen once believed the albatross was the soul of a seaman in a state of bliss. By Wilson's Petrel contains the black soul of a landsman, condemned forever to wander the oceans of the world. 18th century seamen would not, in theory anyway, hurt an albatross. Those of the 19th century, much more familiar with Cape Horn, had fewer scruples. The head and wings made popular decorations. The downstuffed cushions and wing bones were used as paper knives. The lower wing bones were used for pipe stems and the feet used for tobacco pouches. The beak was a coat hanger. If the bird was young and tender, it could also be eaten. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night and talk about more mysteries of the sea. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.